Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. ICE agents were operating in cities across America before Donald Trump returned to office, but with his return, their activities have ramped up, augmented by Border Patrol agents. Americans have witnessed the tactics being used by those agents in rounding up those suspected of being here illegally, and in Charlotte, we have experienced firsthand the impact their actions can have on an immigrant community in particular and on a city as a whole. But nothing compares with what is happening in Minneapolis, where Renee Good lost her life. She was shot by an ICE agent on a neighborhood street. Opinions of what led to that shooting and whether or not it was justified depend on which side of the political divide you find yourself on, but the video taken by bystanders raises many questions and has increased calls for accountability. I think it's safe to say that we've never seen this kind of law enforcement in the United States, with bands of masked, heavily armed individuals pulling people out of cars, pushing them to the ground, forcing them into unmarked vehicles, and whisking them away to God knows where, all without arrest warrants, and denying those detained their constitutionally guaranteed rights to due process. These actions have raised questions, serious questions, about who these ICE agents are and Border Patrol agents, how they are being recruited and trained, about what they can and cannot legally do. And there are also questions about our rights as citizens. So this hour, a conversation about that. We're joined by Nick Miroff, staff writer at The Atlantic, who covers immigration, the Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S.-Mexico border. He's written extensively about ICE and their recent operations. He joins us along with Isha Jain, the Henry P. Brandis Distinguished Professor of Law at the UNC School of Law, where she focuses on immigration and criminal law enforcement. And Julian Berger is WFAE's race and equity reporter who has been covering ICE and Border Patrol activities and the impact of their operations here in Charlotte. Thank you all for being with us this morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Nick, let me start with you, because you have written extensively about ICE and Border Patrol. And in one article, you quote Gregory Bovino, the Border Patrol commander, saying, quote, "This is our effing country. Nobody tells us where to go, when to go, how to go in our effing country." Aside from a public official using the F word, is that attitude, is this approach to law enforcement and to how the government operates on our streets normal?
It is far from normal, Mike. You were talking about how extraordinary this moment is and how we have never seen a federal law enforcement, you know, deployment of this kind. That is certainly true of Mr. Bovino. He has been given a title, commander at large, that didn't exist in the Border Patrol. And he is, you know, at the tip of the spear for this kind of rolling campaign that, as your listeners in Charlotte know well, has gone to several cities now, starting in Los Angeles, then Chicago, and then you know, has moved on from there. He is, of course, on the ground in Minneapolis with hundreds of Border Patrol agents who are nowhere, you know, near the border and who are trained to operate in a border environment. They, they are used to doing what is known within DHS as area control. So, somebody who comes into their area is automatically triggers suspicion. They want to check that person. They are not urban police officers. They are not used to working on the streets of American cities like this, especially in terms of dealing with, you know, American citizens. And they have been empowered to, you know, very aggressively, conduct searches and checks on people and inquire about their status. That is why we're seeing images of Border Patrol agents walking through retail parking lots, asking people, you know, where they're from, what their citizenship is, and even asking for papers. And, again, this is really unprecedented in our country's history. And it is, you know, a big factor in producing the kind of confrontations we're seeing in Minneapolis.
So given the fact that they don't have the training to work in urban atmospheres and deal with people on city streets, which goes without saying, is that a bug in the system or is that intentional? Because they're taking a really macho approach to all of this. It's not, it's an aggressive, in-your-face, I'm the boss, you're a peon approach.
Well, Greg Bovino is out there because ICE was not delivering the kind of results that Stephen Miller and in the White House wanted. You know, President Trump set this goal of millions of deportations. They got tens of billions of dollars through the big, beautiful bill to, you know, to produce those results. And ICE was never, you know, until now has not been postured, has not been right-sized to do anything of that nature. And ICE officers are not trained to go out and just grab people on the streets. They are trained to do what they call targeted enforcement, where they research, you know, the person they're looking for. They try to determine the safest and least confrontational way to bring them into custody. They do not go out and just try to rack up numbers. And so when ICE was not delivering those results, the White House looked to bring in more, you know, support for them and more manpower and certainly a more aggressive approach. And that's how Commander Bovino ended up in this situation. And he has, you know, been used, I think, you know, to model the kind of approach that the White House and Stephen Miller in particular really want. And that is to go out and try to get your, you know, as many arrest and deportation numbers as possible and to create content for the political spectacle that they are leaning so heavily into.
And people in the Trump administration,
Bovino travels, he travels with a film crew. And so they make, you know, they make rap videos, they make, you know, all kinds of content for social media that then reinforces to the president's supporters what they're trying to do.
And people in the Trump administration will tell you that's what they were elected to do. I'm not sure that American citizens knew what they were buying when they said yes to this. But you point out that when Trump ran for office against Kamala Harris, he, quote, wanted voters to tie the problems in their communities and their personal lives to the chaos at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's a stretch at best. But what doesn't appear to be a stretch is the chaos and impact of ICE and Border Patrol operations in our streets across American cities. People have now been shot and killed. Another one was shot last night, injured, disappeared in actions that look like a third world dictatorship. And aside from the stated goal, is this the whole intent, the fear and the chaos? Is the fact that these officers are acting like thugs in many cases, and apparently at the behest of somebody who appears to be acting like a tin pot dictator, is that the intent?
I mean, this is an administration that is exercising executive power in a way that we have not seen in our lifetimes, and you know, imposing its will on Democratic-led blue cities and blue states, whose politicians are some of the president's sharpest critics, is a big part of the political optics of what this administration wants to do. And you know, the United States has not historically had like a federal police force that is beholden to the executive branch and the White House. That's why, you know, in your local cities and states, the police officers have name tags and they show their faces because they're accountable to the local communities. They have to answer to elected officials, and in some cases they themselves are elected. This is entirely different. These are federal forces being sent in almost like, you know, conquering armies, and they're treating it that way. They're armed for this kind of thing. They're in masks, they're in commando gear, they're in camouflage. So, you know, the White House seems to really delight in the kind of scenes that this is producing and the kind of way that these images reinforce the president's power. But it's just something, you know, far beyond the pale of what I think most people are used to.
Which gets us to the legality of all this. Isha, I know you want to comment. Go ahead.
I just wanted to second something Nick mentioned, which is there is a huge difference between local police, local law enforcement doing their everyday patrolling duties, even when that involves, you know, stops and arrests, and these federal officers who are swooping in. And it's not, it's, you know, not just about the optics, it's also about the scope of the legal authority. So in terms of what, you know, this resembles in some cases, I think it resembles what is a Terry stop. So back, you know, in the 1960s, when we were looking at whether or not police officers had the right to do this, it was interesting because back then the government made this argument that we can just engage in stops whenever we want to without reasonable suspicion, without probable cause. And the court rejected that. But the reason that they rejected it had to do a lot with the police officer's institutional expertise. So the court in that case said, look, this police officer has been working these streets, these exact same streets, for 30 years. They relied on the police officer saying, I know the people here, I know what these streets look like, I'm a member of this community. And that's why when I say I see reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop, that means something, right? What's happening now when these federal officers are coming in, they have no connection in many cases at all to the community whatsoever. And there's also a really large literature on the problem with quotas when it comes to arrests and stops, because it's predictable that it's going to lead to officers not looking at things that we want, right? Is this reasonable? Does this make sense? And it's going to lead to violations of the Fourth Amendment, which applies to all government actors, including ICE officers.
Only if they believe that, because getting back to Gregory Bovino's comment that Nick quoted in his article, he says nobody tells us where to go, when to go, how to go in our effing country. And that was underlined just a couple of days ago in a tweet put out by the Department of Homeland Security and written allegedly by Stephen Miller, who is not a part of the Department of Homeland Security. So I'm not sure why he's tweeting on their tweet channel, but he writes to all ICE officers, quote, you have federal immunity in the conduct of your duties. Anybody who lays a hand on you or tries to stop you or tries to obstruct you is committing a felony. You have immunity to perform your duties, and no one, no city official, no state official, no illegal alien, no leftist agitator or domestic insurrectionist can prevent you from fulfilling your legal obligations and duties. The Department of Justice has made clear that if officials cross that line into obstruction, into criminal conspiracy against the United States or against ICE officers, then they will face justice, signed Stephen Miller. I've never heard language like that before from a federal official. He's accusing people who protest, essentially, or try to stop things from happening, of engaging in a criminal conspiracy. Is that the way they're going to approach that? And if they do, is that legal?
I think this has an enormous potential for chilling First Amendment protected activity. So just to be clear, right, we all have the right to record. We have the right to do that. We have legal rights to protest. There is a line between when that crosses the line to obstructing government action. And so I think that there is a blurry line, right, where between someone who's just not involved, not obstructing, just recording, and someone who, say, is physically interfering or, arguably blocking officers from doing their duty. But to the extent those comments seem to suggest that there's no line, right, that just, you know, recording is problematic, I think that's really crossing a line.
And as you say, they're operating without training in urban environments, in areas without communicating with police, which we experienced here in Charlotte. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what that means for city and state officials who are having their cities invaded, essentially.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about ICE and Border Patrol actions in cities around America, including our own, and of course, they're in Minneapolis right now. We're talking about that with Nick Miroff. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, who writes extensively about this. Esha Jane is a professor of law at the UNC School of Law, and Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter here at WFAE. There was a shooting last night in Minneapolis of an illegal immigrant, allegedly illegal immigrant, by ICE or Border Patrol. He was injured, not killed, and taken to a hospital. Julian, we witnessed last night, if you were up on watching television late last night, the mayor of Minneapolis, Mayor Fry, who seemed to be at his wit's end because he's trying to keep the violence down, and it appears that these ICE agents are trying to ramp the violence up. And he's encouraging his citizens not to take the bait. These people are operating with immunity in these American cities, according to Stephen Miller. Where does that put local officials? How did our local officials react to this?
Yeah, I think our local officials, we saw back in November when CBP came to Charlotte that our local officials stood up. They were very vocal. They were trying to stand up against this. And I think our local officials, if this were to happen in our own streets, would act the same way. They would be very vocal and take a very firm stand against what's happening in our own city.
But that's pretty much the limit, Esha, of their ability in this case, is it not? They can complain, they can have press conferences, but they have no way to push back, correct?
So I want to, you know, talk about this concept of, you know, pushing back and setting baselines for what is reasonable, because I think that sometimes these issues are framed as, look, if you support tougher border control, if you're in favor of tougher immigration enforcement, then this is something you shouldn't be concerned with. But I think what's happening here should be something everybody is concerned with, regardless of their views on the substance of immigration enforcement, because this is about, you know, something I think that's quintessentially American, right? Your right to walk down the street and feel confident that you're going to be left alone and that someone is not going to arbitrarily stop you or use force. So just with regard to one Fourth Amendment issue here. So there's part of what I think happens, and this goes back to your earlier question in terms of, you know, what's the problem here? Part of what I think it's important to not normalize is the erosion of this idea that you have the right to be left alone from the government unless there is, unless they have reasonable suspicion or probable cause. And that goes back to, it's something that the courts are continually wrestling with, right? What's a reasonable expectation of privacy? And that's something, I think there one important way to hold officials accountable is to protest, is to, in terms of notifying law enforcement, whether it be your local law enforcement, a local civil liberties organization, writing a complaint. All of these are important ways to document that there are excessive uses of force or unlawful arrests. And just documenting this, I think, is an important step in terms of trying to hold actors accountable here.
So even people who are in favor of stemming the flow of illegal immigration, what they're complaining about is the tactics being used in these American cities across the country. And Julian, those tactics are designed, I think, to send a message to certain communities, well, everybody, but to specifically to the immigrant community. What message was received here?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing here was that they're not welcome here. I think what happened in November, it left a very big chilling effect. I like to call it, it was similar to the COVID pandemic. When CBP was here, it was a total lockdown for our immigrant community. Nobody went to work. Nobody dropped their kids off at school. Everybody kind of stood home if you were an immigrant. Even if you had some sort of status like a visa or a green card, you stood home. And the weeks after CBP left, we've kind of seen, it was like summer of 2020 where, okay, we're kind of, it's a little bit more safer to go out, but still precautions. So people would go to work, but then immediately come back and not go grocery shopping as much as they would, not go out and go to social gatherings as much. So it's left a very big chilling effect in, they're not welcome here and that they should be fearful of being in the United States.
Well, people on the right are more forgiving of this than people on the left. People on the left are appalled by what they're witnessing, and I think we should all be appalled by it because this is not American. This is not what we do in this country, and this is not how we enforce our laws, except in the most dire of circumstances. And these are not the most dire of circumstances. Nick, you have written, I know you want to talk about this, but you have written that Trump has turned Gregory Bovino's Border Patrol agents into a personal army, as well as a political tool, picking which cities he wants them to strike. So far, mostly blue cities. And this morning on Truth Social, Donald Trump posted this: "If the corrupt politicians of Minnesota don't obey the law and stop the professional agitators and insurrectionists from attacking the patriots of ICE, who are only trying to do their job, I will institute the Insurrection Act, which many presidents have done before me, and quickly put an end to the travesty that is taking place in that once great state." Is that the end game? To institute the Insurrection Act, have martial law on the streets of America, and have complete totalitarian control?
I don't know if that is the end game. I can tell you that Stephen Miller has been talking about the Insurrection Act for as long as I've been observing him in politics, for at least a decade, and has long viewed it as a tool to sort of push through and squash any resistance to what to what he wanted the Department of Homeland Security and federal agencies to do in terms of mass deportations.
And I guess the more serious question is, as you bring in federal forces to peaceful American cities and ramp up the violence, whether they take the bait or not, you are normalizing the visuals of people in military combat gear and masks carrying heavy weapons into American cities facing off against American citizens. You are normalizing that, which is, I think, dangerous. Is
Yeah, I think,
this,
I mean, I think a
are,
key
but are we, but
distinction.
are we, nor, are we normalizing this in a buildup to the elections?
So I'm not an expert on the history of the Insurrection Act, but from my understanding is that this would be declared in a specific area. It's not like national martial law. It's in response to a set of circumstances. So it would mobilize and unlock, these kind of supreme authorities to deal with a specific situation, in this case, Minneapolis. And of course, the president is right that the Insurrection Act, I think, has been invoked, but it's often because of a, in response to something that was obviously happening on its own, rioting after Rodney King. I'm not aware of all of the examples, but it's something that everybody can recognize as a situation that appears out of control, in contrast to something that the federal government and the executive branch, then the White House create, and then there is a response, and then they come in with more force. I think that would be the big difference here.
They said when they started these operations that they were going to go after the worst of the worst. That has not proven to be the case, as the best we can determine. Of course, we can't really determine anything because most of these people that they pick up off the street are disappeared and sent away, and we never hear from them again. And they have no due process, except in a few minor cases. You have said, Isha, that one of the most important rights I think all people have, citizens and non-citizens alike, is the right to be left alone by the government, which is the Fourth Amendment, left alone by the government when they're walking down the street. The government is not supposed to arrest you without probable cause. Those are your words. Most of us have probably never thought about that because that right has never been tested legally. What makes it a right? Is it the Fourth Amendment?
So it's the Fourth Amendment. I have to say, so protests can look a lot of different ways. When I think of this, I think about one of the quintessentially American things that we all get to do is we can hold up a sign saying that we disagree with what an elected official is doing, and the government, that's what you're doing, holding up a sign to say that I disagree. That's something that's pretty special, that you have the right to do that in America, and that's not reasonable suspicion, that's not probable cause. So I think it's really important to recognize, you know, what's triggering government action, right? Like, what are they doing here? I also do want to put this in a bit of a historical context with regard to the Fourth Amendment. One thing that is really important to think about is, in the context of criminal procedure, right, oftentimes these types of cases come up, and the question is, well, the government did something to somebody, and it's, you know, so they surveilled someone, they arrested someone, and the question is, you know, are they allowed to do this? And it might be in any individual case that there's evidence that the person has committed a crime, but the key issue is that these rights apply to everyone. So if the government can do this in this case, they can do it in everyone else. The key case that is coming up pretty frequently, it's been cited a lot, is a case from the 1960s, Katz. And in that case, what the government did was secretly tap a public phone booth. And the argument was that, you know, this is a public phone booth. You aren't entitled to have a right to privacy here. And the court said, no, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So that question, what are we allowed to do? What's a reasonable expectation of privacy? When is the government violating your rights?
Well, let me
That's
ask you
continuing
a specific,
to come up.
Let me ask you a specific yeah. question about that, because ICE and Border Patrol agents engaged in these operations, some cases are merely approaching people on the street and asking them mm-hmm. if they're a citizen. And they're doing that, apparently, based on the way they look, on their accent, or the fact that they are maybe speaking Spanish or some other foreign language. Is that legal?
So it depends on the context, right? Like, so police officers, government officials, they have the right to talk to people, right? What they don't have the right to do without some legal process is to keep you from leaving, right? But government actors are, and police, like, this has long been the case. They're entitled to go up to people on the street and ask them questions. And you're entitled to say, I want to talk to you, or I don't want to talk to you, right? So the question isn't whether or not they're allowed to come up and ask a question. The question is whether or not they're allowed to hold you if you refuse to answer. So I would say, you know, if it's context specific, it depends on what they're doing and what the person is doing. But one thing someone could generally do is to just ask, you know, am I required to answer? Am I free to go, right? If there's any ambiguity about that.
Julian, one of the things that we witnessed in Charlotte, which seemed alarming at the time, now pales in comparison to many of the things that we're seeing happening on the streets of Minneapolis. So as the immigrant community, well, ICE came and went, but they're liable to come back. Not ICE, but the Border Patrol came and went, but they're liable to come back. They've said they're liable to come back, and in fact, they've maintained a small presence here, allegedly. Is what people are witnessing happening in Minneapolis within the immigrant community here, is that engendering even more fear perhaps than the operation that was in operation here at Thanksgiving?
Yeah, I think Sheriff McFadden of Mecklenburg County has said that CBP is expected to come back to Charlotte. That's been big news in our immigrant community. And I think what's been happening in Minneapolis is causing fear. I think CBP is ramping up the way in which they are looking for people to arrest and deport. Their actions are becoming more brutal and more violent. And I mean, just yesterday, I got messages from people about misinformation that was circling about CBP coming back, and it was a fake news headline. And they were like, oh gosh, are they really coming back to Charlotte now? And so I think there's a lot of fear, and there's also a lot of misinformation based off of what is happening in Minneapolis.
What we're watching in Minneapolis, it might be part and parcel of how many people they have hired to do these jobs, because they have hired people in the thousands over the last 11 months, Nick, to become ICE and Border Patrol agents so that they can be on the streets of American cities. Who are the people they are hiring? How are they being vetted? Are they undergoing any kind of psychological evaluation like a person applying to be a police officer might be subject to? I mean, do they know who these people are?
Yes. On the whole, they know who they are. I mean, you said it's an 11-month timeline. It's actually much shorter than that. I mean, this is a hiring surge that is enabled by the money from the Big Beautiful Bill. And they set a goal of 10,000 hires 10,000 new deportation officers by this month, by January. And they say that they have met that goal. That is going to more than double the size of the ICE workforce. And so I attended one of their job expos in Dallas last year. I talked to many of the recruits who were seeking jobs with ICE. I can tell you that you know, they have targeted, you know, they say that they got more than 250,000 or whatever applications for these 10,000 jobs. A lot of them are law enforcement officers who are already employed with other agencies. That's who they really wanted to hire. And I think for the most part, you know, based on the conversations I've had, that they were able to do that. So these are people who work for cities and, you know, state police agencies and who can just get a much better job working for ICE and tell ICE, you know, where they want to live.
So they are offering, I believe, a monetary incentive to join. You have to be in the organization for a certain number of time before you get the whole, I think it's $50,000, but there's a
it's
monetary...
$10,000 a year for okay. Up to 5 years.
For 5 years. So there's a monetary incentive here. There's also a quota, evidently, on the number of people they need to apprehend once they become an agent. So between the two of those, can we assume that at least some of them are joining because A, they want the money, but B, they're looking forward to holding these positions of power?
I think that, you know, that is probably part of it. I didn't get that sense, you know, that wasn't the overwhelming sense from the recruits that I spoke with in Dallas last year. A lot of them were, you know, who you would recognize as sort of, you know, ordinary Americans, many with military service who are looking for better jobs, looking for more stable employment, looking for the opportunity to break in with the federal government and federal law enforcement. And I didn't see a lot of, you know, people who at least explicitly stated that they, you know, wanted to go out and, you know, like carry out Trump's agenda and impose their, you know, the Make America Great agenda on their local communities, anything like that. And so, you know, but I think the financial incentives are pretty large. And that's one of the reasons they got so many applications.
I have 30 seconds. Can you hire this many people and properly train them?
No, not this fast. Properly, no.
Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that training and also about what evidently is a developing amount of friction between the old guard within ICE and Border Patrol and these new hires, because there's evidently some, you write about some friction development. We'll talk about that when we come back. We have to take a break. Nick Muroff is with us. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Isha Jain, a professor of law at the UNC School of Law. And Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter here at WFAE News. We'll continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their small classes offer a supportive learning environment where middle schoolers can develop curiosity and essential skills like critical thinking, collaboration, and problem solving. Details at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the ICE and Border Patrol on America's streets and the impact that they are having in the intent of their usage by the administration. Nick Muroff is a staff writer for The Atlantic who has written extensively about this. Isha Jain, professor of law. We have some legal questions for her in a moment from the UNC School of Law. And Julian Berger is WFAE's race and equity reporter. So they've hired thousands of people very quickly, Nick, in this last several months, and they're putting them through training, but you just said they're not training them as well as they might or might have in ordinary times. So how has the training changed, and is that leading to some of the behaviors that we're seeing on the streets?
Well, the short answer is no, because most of the new hires have not hit the streets yet, and it's worth remembering that Officer Jonathan Ross, who shot Renee Good, was a highly trained veteran, you know, ICE officer with more than 10 years of experience. So, you know, it is not the case that we're seeing this behavior because the officers are brand new and new recruits. In fact, I've heard from some, including from some ICE veterans who thought that it would potentially be beneficial to have more officers who are trained in urban policing and who are accustomed to dealing with the public. Assuming that they can get, you know, good quality hires, it would be beneficial to have some of them in ICE now because they are interacting so much more with the public in this, you know, in this way. The 10,000 hires, they haven't hit the streets, but I can tell you that for new recruits, and again, this is a subset of the 10,000 that they've wanted to hire. New recruits do have to go through the academy. The academy training course used to be about 5 months, and they have cut that by more than half in order to fast track the new recruits onto the streets as quickly as possible.
On the one hand, you just said that some people think that it might be a good idea to have new recruits who are trained in urban policing, but you also say that for months you've received warnings from veteran ICE officials who say the administration has lowered ICE's standards, and you say morale has never been lower within that agency. Is that based on what they've already seen, since these people are not on the street? What's that based on?
That is based on the impression of veteran ICE officers who are hearing that, you know, nearly more than a third of the new recruits who have gone to the academy have failed because they failed the physical fitness test, that many others have failed the, you know, written exams. And so they're concerned about the quality of some of these new hires. So again, I want to distinguish between experienced local and state police officers that ICE is recruiting and who may end up helping, you know, calm things down by bringing a little more urban policing experience, and new recruits who have never been police officers before, who they're bringing in and they're fast tracking onto the streets. Those are the ones that ICE veterans are worried about because they're going to have to work alongside them, and they're not sure that they can trust them.
You also say that you spoke with several current and former ICE officials, experienced officers, about how they viewed the shooting of Renee and Nicole Good in Minneapolis. You say that one official described it as murder, while others defended that officer's actions. Time magazine reports that one former ICE agent with more than 25 years of experience told them, quote, "The majority of my colleagues feel the same way. It's an insult to us because we did it the right way." He said that he was embarrassed. Is there tension between the old guard and how things are being operated now?
Certainly, there are a lot of very unhappy veterans at ICE who have had longstanding concerns about the politicization of the agency and of immigration enforcement in general, and are now increasingly concerned that they're being used almost like political tools to go out and stage the kind of political confrontations that the White House wants. And they think it's detrimental long term to the national security mission that they signed up for. They want to be out there, and this is, and you know, I'm speaking particularly to the Homeland Security Investigations Wing of ICE, whose agents, you know, are used to going after drug cartels and sex traffickers and things like that, and are now, you know, being pushed out onto the streets of Minneapolis to confront, you know, protesters who are screaming in their faces. So
And I
that's
understand that,
that's
but
a,
I understand that they're trained to be tough on these people who are crossing the border illegally and who may be parts of drug cartels, but these are American citizens on the streets of America, and these people are Americans. These ICE agents and Border Patrol agents are Americans. If what looks un-American to us must seem odd to them at the very least.
yeah, this is not what they signed up to do.
Okay. The officer who shot and killed Renee Good was allegedly one of these more seasoned officers. As Nick said, he had 10 years of experience, and yet he made some rookie mistakes in Minnesota, rather, like walking in front of an occupied vehicle, which they're trained not to do. He was making a cell phone recording of this incident the entire time. Maybe he was told to, I don't know. When an officer fires a shot under normal circumstances, they're told to act to preserve the evidence, to render aid to anyone who was injured. That did not happen in this case, and to surrender their firearm. I don't know whether that happened either. What does that say, Aisha, about either the officers that they have on the streets or the instructions that they're operating under?
You know, so I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions, and there's going to be in any individual case, but I can tell you about just what checks we have when things like this happen. So just to take a step back, you know, I think that there's always going to be a lot of disagreement about what immigration enforcement should look like. I think that's reasonable, and that ought to be resolved through the political process. I also think, though, that there's a way to do that and to have law enforcement involved in a way that accounts for training, provides for accountability. And so typically what you'd see in, if this was, you know, a local law enforcement context, there would be a debate and discussion about this, are our officers going to have body-worn cameras? Are they going to be automatically on? Are there certain circumstances in which they're going to take them off or on? And what would that mean if there is a dispute that happened down the line? To go back to some of what Nick mentioned earlier, part of what happens when you're a local police officer, even if you're a local police officer who is working with ICE, right? You're in a locality that does that, is that it's absolutely predictable that you would need to interact with all kinds of people, including people who might not like what you're doing, including people who might be upset, including people who are just standing and recording, and someone who may or may not have heard an officer give an order or not, right? Like these are all predictable things that happen all the time. I think one of the problems is with regard to ICE agents coming into cities where they don't have those local connections, is it's much harder to know what the training is, how that relates to what local police are doing, whether or not you're dealing even with ICE or a local police officer, and whether or not they're violating what their own training is. We just have a lot of trouble getting that information.
Cities have spent a lot of time in recent years trying to teach police officers de-escalation tactics. That is not something that is happening with these officers for various different reasons. We have a responsibility too, those of us who are walking down the street and who may be approached by ICE or by Border Patrol. So what are our rights? What must we do if we're approached by one of these officers? And what can we refuse to do by law?
So I think just a common sense thing that everybody should always do is to remain calm, right? Like nobody should, I think we have a mutual interest in not escalating and causing, escalation in terms of violence or anything like that. So I think it's just a common sense thing that everyone should always stay calm. But I think there's also this room for dialogue as a general matter. Nobody is entitled to, the government can't stop you or keep you from leaving or detain you without probable cause for an arrest, reasonable suspicion for a stop. So, and as a general matter, people are entitled to record, but they're not entitled to interfere with immigration officers or police officers who are undertaking lawful enforcement actions. So I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Nick, has anyone told us why these officers are permitted, perhaps required, to obscure their identity by wearing face masks and why the uniforms they're wearing have very little identification about who the individual is and sometimes who the agency that they belong to happens to be? And they drive unmarked cars for the most part. Why?
So they're not required to wear masks. The agency leaders at ICE have said that they don't like them, but that they can't tell the officers and agents to take them off because they're sympathetic to the concerns about being doxxed. And so I can tell you that a lot of veteran ICE officers know that the masks are escalatory. They make tensions and interactions with the public much worse. But they feel like they need them. They feel the doxing threat that they think that they face, and doxing again is having your identity revealed online, which could lead to harassment for your family. And so the refrain you often hear from them is like, I signed up for this, but my family didn't. And so the masks, they say, are, this way to protect their family. But I can tell you, it's also a way to provide a kind of buffer from the work that they're having to do. They are out in the public on the streets in a way that they've never, comfortable with. And they know that every time they go out on the street, they could potentially end up in some sort of viral video. And that can be like a life-changing thing. And so the having a mask gives them this little kind of veneer of protection, even though that they know ultimately it's bad for their mission.
But if somebody pulls up in an unmarked car, decked out in military gear, carrying military equipment and guns, Isha, and they knock on your window and they tell you they want to see your identification, or they tell you to get out of the car, or they reach in and they pull you out of the car, is a possible defense for not cooperating with them is that you don't know who these people are. They could be the Proud Boys or some militia.
I mean, I think that, so best, this is partially why, like, there is a best practices in terms of what the government agents should be doing. So part of the reason it's important for police officers or law enforcement officials to identify themselves is precisely so we don't have this dispute. Whether or not someone's going to be able to defend themselves down the road is going to be a context-specific action. But I think that just to go back to what Julian was talking about earlier with regard to chilling effects, I mean, this is really not a question that you want to be in a position of asking. So it's like one way of approaching that is to ask, identify yourself and am I under arrest? Am I free to leave? And that could be one way of getting more information and de-escalating a situation.
I'm going to come back to identity in a second. Julian, go ahead.
Yeah, just to piggyback off of that, I think here locally in Charlotte, we've seen that CMPD has to kind of work double to kind of make sure that the immigrant community knows that they're separate from ICE. We've seen that there's been numerous community engagement events, especially throughout the holidays, to kind of welcome the immigrant community into the CMPD stations here in the neighborhoods. There's been numerous statements put out within Spanish media from CMPD to tell them, hey, we're not ICE, we don't work with ICE. Please, we welcome the immigrant community here in our city. So yeah, just they've been working really hard to differentiate themselves from ICE.
So I'm really short on time, Isha, but I'm curious, when they ask you for proof of citizenship, what constitutes that proof?
So just to go back, I sometimes get asked about this, like whether or not people, I just want to point out that a lot of us don't walk around with, identification documents or their passports or whatnot. So I think just to go back to that question of even before that, like can a person stop you and require that you show your papers? I think that that should be the first question that you're asking, right? It's going to be a context-specific judgment, but you could say, why, who are you, and am I required to show this? And I think
So
the
what
short
do you
answer is
show?
it depends
Excuse
on
me,
where.
I'm really short on time. What constitutes proof of citizenship? Does a driver's license do it? Do you have to have your passport? Do you have to have your green card? What constitutes citizenship? Very quickly.
I mean, it depends again on the context, right? You don't have to carry any of these papers on with you, right? I want to go back to that.
Correct.
So if a person stops me and asks me, and I don't have anything on me, that doesn't mean that they can show that I'm not a citizen.
So very quickly, the use of the word show your papers brings up what Joe Rogan talked about the other day. He's a very popular bro podcaster and a supporter of Donald Trump. And he used the word Gestapo to describe tactics being used by federal agents who are stopping people and asking to see their papers. The use of the word Gestapo gets your attention because usually if you refer to the tactics being used by this administration as fascist, you're accused of hyperbole. This is certainly un-American behavior, but is it Gestapo or fascist-like, Nick?
I tend to steer away from comparisons to the Nazis. I don't think that this administration is trying to mass murder Americans. But these are these are the trappings of authoritarian government rule that we all recognize. And it doesn't have to be the Gestapo. It can be the kinds of behaviors that we've seen in autocracies for in many other societies. And our country is different. We have always prided ourselves on being different and on protecting individual liberties. And that is a reason, a big reason, why so many Americans are deeply disturbed at what they're seeing.
Very quickly, there are policies in place to hold local law enforcement accountable. Is there anything in place for ICE or Border Patrol? I have 10 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's called Congress, but Congress has to, you know, do its job.
Ah, and therein lies the rub. Nick Miroff, staff writer for The Atlantic, Isha Jain, professor of law at the UNC School of Law, and Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.